supersymmetry and the LHC inverse problem. So I am a model builder, and to me, this is what particle physics looks like in the year 2006. As a model builder, I have two options for what I can do spending my time. Do I build new models, a better model of supersymmetry? Or do I think about how to test for those models at the LHC? And in 2 years' time, we're going to have some new information. So clearly, this lever is going to swing towards the way of testing models in the future. Let me just say that in the meantime, there are still models worth building. There have been some people who are trying to get the best SUSY model ever. I'll talk a little bit more about the little hierarchy problem, but these people are trying to stare the little hierarchy problem dead on and say, what is the best way of solving that? Also, some new models have come out that are interesting because they're proof of concept models. The so-called twin peaks theories prove the concept that you can solve the hierarchy problem without having any new fields in our visible sector, that you can cure the quadratic divergence of the Higgs mass by having all hidden sector fields. Some other models that people have been thinking about lately, unnatural theories. My office mates have been pursuing this idea of minimal dark matter. What is the minimal particle content to get dark matter gauge coupling implication? And those of us with a little more of an eye to the LHC have been thinking about canonical models. And this is some work, more recent work that will come out hopefully soon with Xinjia Cheng and Liantao Wang. We call it little M theory, basically a model whose various limits reproduce a lot of the non-SUSY phenomenology that you might be interested in. But for this talk, I'm thinking about particle physics circa 2008. And in 2008, assuming we have data at that time, the pressing problem for particle physics is going to be how to test models. Do we have some technoclients from Technicolor? Do we see gluinos from SUSY? Are there new spin 1 resonances, some called Z-primes? And so the framework I want you to be thinking about is, roughly speaking, 1 year at the LHC. 1 year at the LHC at low luminosity, we're going to have 10 inverse tempter barns of data. And everyone in this room wants to know, how do you go from experimental data to theoretical models? Now, this question is a huge question. This question involves things like, OK, how do you know that you're seeing something even beyond the standard model? If you're seeing something beyond the standard model, what is the best framework to work in to explain it? Is it supersymmetry? Is it not supersymmetry? A huge array of questions that are going into this very simple statement, how do you go from experimental data to theoretical models? Do we need next to next to leading order calculations to make sure we're really confident? OK, I'm going to put those all aside. I'm going to turn standard model background off. I'm going to look at pure signal, just 10 inverse tempter barns of pure signal. And I'm only going to work within the context of the MSSM. And in this extremely unrealistic, contrived context, can we, without forcing constraints on any of these soft parameters, rule in things in the context of the MSSM, like gauge genome unification, thermal relic weak scale dark matter, the value of tan beta? Can we go from experimental data to theoretical models, even in this highly contrived situation? And my collaborators are working on trying to get rid of all those caveats that I just spoke about to see what their full realistic story is. But already, 10 inverse tempter barns, a pure signal, you're going to see some interesting structures in this question of how to go from experimental data to theoretical models. Now, the standard way that people have addressed this problem has been in what I'll call the forward direction. We start with models somewhere in parameter space, and we map them into LHC signature space. This has been the technique that have been, that's presented in the technical design reports for both Atlas and CMS. All sorts of benchmark studies, you may have heard of the snow mass points and slopes, those are going in the forward direction. Taking some model, maybe making small excursions and parameters around that model, but basically just taking a small ball in parameter space, see where it goes to in LHC signature space. And what's fascinating about these studies is that they say, and I think this is true, they say that if you assume a reduced parameter set, such as the reduced parameter set of minimal supergravity, that is just a common gauge genome mass to the high scale, common fermion mass to the high scale, common H-term to the high scale, sine of mu and a value for tan beta, or if you're working in anomaly-mediated supersymmetry breaking or gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking, basically any framework where you don't have more than 4 or 5 parameters, what has been found, and I think this is, again, I think this is true, that LHC data is going to give you precision measurements. This is thinking about LHC data in the forward direction, from parameter space to signature space. What I want to advocate to you is that the real way we should be thinking about LHC data is really in the inverse direction. We want to start off with LHC data and ask, what is the image of that back in parameter space? This is a much more interesting question, even first from a theoretical point of view. I mean, is this map 1-to-1? Or is it essentially one-to-one to the extent that the only lack of one-to-oneness are just an experimental error bars? Again, trying to answer this question, going from data, can we rule in gauge genome unification, dark matter? And what this map looks like, the map from LHC space to parameter space, is very important in thinking about where particle physics should go in the future. I'm not going to say much more about this, but this map, whatever it looks like, could tell you whether a 500 GeV ILC in 10 years is the way that particle physics wants to go. But let me leave that for right now. I'm going to say that the inverse problem is what we should focus on. And you can imagine different ways that this inverse problem could look. In the best of all possible worlds, you take LHC data, bang, it hits a model. Not only does it tell you whether it's Susie, it tells you which Susie it is. In the worst of all possible worlds, you get some LHC data and it basically says, it could be anything. There's new physics beyond the standard model, but we don't know how to interpret it. What I want to argue today is that this is the real picture of the inverse map. Again, this is only in the context of the minimal supersymmetric standard model. I'm not talking about degeneracies within different classes of models. I'm saying within the MSSM, LHC data maps to a bunch of little small balls that cover a large region of parameter space. So if you were doing a forward direction study, you would look at one of these small balls, you've already thought it's a gauge-mediated supersymmetry break, and you look at one of these small balls and you say, wow, if I make little excursions over here, I get outside of the error bars on the signature side. You would say you'd get precision measurements. But if you were to make extremely large excursions, you would find other regions in the parameter space that gave you the same LHC data, the same signature. This is the picture. This is the picture that I'm going to try to motivate in this talk. And this is the picture that I want you to take away at the end of this talk. And if you have any debates on this, that's the kind of debate that I would love to hear.
So no broad bands.
No broad, oh, there may be broad bands. There may be flat directions, for example. That's not drawn on here. We don't know what the actual codimensionality, if you want, of these regions are. But in some sense, there are balls in certain directions. For example, the galeno mass is not a large flat direction. But there may be cases where, in a certain region, you can take any value of the slepton mass above a certain value, and they would all give you the exact same thing. So there may be you know, strings, loops. Who knows what the topology of this mass looks like? And that would be an even more fascinating question. But here, I just want to make the argument that there's some sense of isolation of the different regions and parameters.
Yes. So you are doing this for the LHC, which is going to happen.
Yeah.
Would you have done this for experiments that
absolutely
have already been done?
You could have done this in the case of, or people are thinking about this in the case of the Tevatron.
Yes.
People are asking, are there scenarios where, for example, the LHC sees degeneracies, but if you go back to Tevatron data and you make the appropriate cuts, that you could actually break those degeneracies because the backgrounds are different at the Tevatron? You could have done those. In the absence of data, there's no reason to do it. This is assuming that you've seen a signal, and the signal is big. And so in the absence of any 5-sigma deviations from the standard model at the Tevatron that we trust, it's not worth doing that study at this point for that machine. It may be interesting to see, once we make a discovery, whether we can go back to Tevatron data and see if we can eke out some more information.
Well, basically, my question is even simpler. It's like, suppose you come out with a different model, different from the standard model.
Yes.
Would there be another point different in these parameter spaces?
It would be extremely difficult to modify the standard model given the precision electroweak test that we have. Basically, the information from LEPTU and our studies of the top of our Tevatron.
The dots would be very, very far apart, perhaps.
It's hard to change. I mean, if you're working with fixed particle content, that you're not allowing yourself new states, then while there.
I'm allowing anything else.
Okay, good. You're allowing anything else. Okay, let me first stick with fixed particle content. In fixed particle content, currently there is a degeneracy, and that is the hierarchy of the neutrinos, whether it's a standard inverted hierarchy. So that's a degeneracy that you need more data to fix. That would be something that you would learn in this kind of study. In terms of adding new particles, you could try to hide and add new particles and then hide them in the context of the standard model, but we have no theoretical motivation to do so. So no reason to try to add a new particle that doesn't solve a 5-sigma fluctuation, I guess is what I would say. Does that answer what you're...
Yes. Okay, so basically you're saying that if the LHC measures very neatly things...
LHC sees...
Then these dots would be very, very far apart, but there would be no sense.
I wouldn't say that they're very far apart. I would say that they're not relevant. that let's say you could say, come on, you can always make degeneracies. Here, I'm going to put in a 2000 TeV Z prime. That's degenerate with the standard model. Okay, well, you can't see it. It's a degeneracy because it's decoupled, so it's not actually a useful notion of degeneracies. I want to have a case of degeneracies where it's not a case of decoupling. Okay. Yeah.
How large is this parameter space?
This parameter space, I'm going to tell you more about it later, but it's a 15-dimensional parameter space. So it's not the full variation in the MSSM, but it's a pretty large one. So let me motivate the inverse problem a little more. I mean, one response to this research has been, come on, do experimentalists really need our help? They know a lot about theories. They know how to use their data. Do they need us to come in and say, look, this is a problem with degeneracies? Well, in terms of solving the inverse problem, they don't really need our help in a bunch of cases. If there's some really striking signal for it, for example, a long-lived Galeno at 300 GeV, they're going to find it, and it's going to be pretty unambiguous what that stands for. If there's a 2 TeV Z prime, there may be some degeneracies about whether that Z prime is a B minus L Z prime or a B minus half L Z prime with a different coupling. Okay, but those things we can imagine working out later. And if it's a Higgs and nothing else, then we're in precision physics land, and this kind of story that I'm talking about won't really be relevant. What I want to claim is that any model of TeV scale physics with a Z2 symmetry and heaviest colored particles, those kind of models are the kind of models where you have a big chance of degeneracies. Now, these models happen to be models like supersymmetry, has a Z2 symmetry, R parity. And we think that there may be heaviest colored particles for the following reason. I'll call this the LHC problem or little hierarchy problem. That precision electroweak tests have told us that the size of higher dimensional operators is suppressed by 5 to 10 TeV. And direct bounds on new particles are kind of pushing everything heavier. And if you assume a flavor-independent mediation scheme for SUSY, then colored particles are generically heavier than electroweak particles. So if you take these things together, in order to satisfy the direct bounds, we have to push the masses of electroweak guys higher. But in flavor-independent mediation scheme SUSY, like gating mediation or anomaly mediation, you have to push the colored guys heavier, decreasing the cross-section for creating those colored guys. And so because the LHC is a PP collider and mostly makes colored stuff, the cross-section is a little bit small if there's a heavy Galeno. And the standard model background suggests plus missing energy, which would be the characteristic signature of such a scenario with a Z2 symmetry. There's a huge background for that. And so because we don't expect colored particles to be, well, if we're lucky, colored particles are just around the corner. We're in a different situation. But if the Galenos are around 600, 700, 800 GeV, you're getting into the range where you don't have a lot of data over a year. Maybe you have a lot of data over 10 years, but not a lot of data to make precision measurements of anything. Now, I should say that other people have thought about this problem of degeneracies. One of the best studies of one of these benchmark points, SPS1A, this group, Miller, Oslin, and Gelstein, have done a fantastic job talking about, if you were here this morning, about different edges and endpoints, different kinematic signatures, and doing a full scan of them. And they come up with, well, you know, given this full scan, they're actually mass ordering degeneracies that they find. Lester Parker and White developed a Markov chain technique for trying to map out the space of SUSY consistent with different models. And they also find this kind of discrete ambiguity problems. And Patrick Mead and Matt Reese have just put out a paper about model-independent top partners. And what they find is that you can have two theories, one of which has a top partner that's a fermion, one of which has a top partner that's a scalar, and you can actually have degeneracies within those two theories. They look exactly the same, unless you come up with a clever observable, and they have found one clever observable that pretty much breaks that kind of degeneracy. But people are really worried about this question, concerns about uniqueness. Given data at the LHC, is there just going to be one answer? And what I'm going to give to you is I'm going to give you two themes for how to think about this problem of degeneracies. The first theme is a theme that's relevant for any study, be it at the LHC or otherwise, and this is statistics and the inverse problem. If we want to assess the degree of one-to-oneness in a mapping between a theory space and a data space, you would think it's impossible because you don't want to have to cover every corner of, for example, the MSSM. How do you simulate all the models out there? But if we just want to give a proof that there is not a one-to-one map, then we can make use of the birthday problem. That is, it's very unlikely that anyone has my birthday, August 10th. But given this room, I think there's enough of us that it's very likely that two of you will have the same birthday, but you don't know which one it is. And so if we can assemble a giant bucket of MSSMs and compare the different signatures among that giant bucket, we're more likely to find an example of a degeneracy. And then once you have that example of a degeneracy, you can study it to death and understand why did it happen and how do you break it. So that's the first theme here. This is applicable to any theory, be it the MSSM or otherwise. Something more particular to the MSSM, I'll call the theme two, Susie Sleptons and the LHC. And this is the following. Most benchmark studies have the following cascade decay. This is, again, in the context of supersymmetry. We have some electroweak enone that decays to a lepton and a slepton, another lepton, and another electroweak enone. And this golden decay, this golden cascade decay, allows you to place unbelievably strong bounds on theories or make really precise measurements on theories because you can study the dilepton invariant mass distribution and get a huge amount of information. Again, all benchmark studies happen to be ones of this form. It happens to happen generically in gauge mediation. In anomaly mediation, you don't really know because the sleptons are negative, but if you have anomaly mediation plus something else, also generically you tend to have the sleptons beyond shell for this to happen. In minimal supergravity, also this happens. But if you just scan randomly over the MSSM, which is what I'm going to do, you find that generically the sleptons are decoupled. And once the sleptons are decoupled, you lose this brilliant handle on what the structure of a theory is. And once this happens, you find degeneracies. So once again, if you have on-shell sleptons, you probably don't have degeneracies within the MSSM. If you don't have on-shell sleptons, then obviously there's a degeneracy that the sleptons could be arbitrarily heavy, but I'm not talking about flat corrections. I'm saying that there's degeneracies introduced in another sector, in particular in the electroweak enone sector. So these are the two things that I'm going to give you today. Okay, I can talk in infinite detail about our study. I have a few slides. I can go on as long as you want about the particulars, but let's do at least the following. I'm going to tell you about our statistical technique, and then after convincing you that there are degeneracies, I'm going to go back more systematically and look at the kind of models we simulated. And as I said before, we're going to do a 15-parameter scan of the MSSM. We're using a lot of LHC observables. Some of them are irrelevant, basically 1,800 LHC observables. A lot of them are just empty histograms, unfortunately, because we have a bunch of observables corresponding to this dilepton invariant mass distribution, which happens to be absent in most of the parameter space we're scanning. And the thing that you should really focus on, if you care about the MSSM, is this section here. What kind of degeneracies are there? What types of theories look the same, have the same LHC data? And we'll see that they can be classified in terms of operators on the electroweak enone sector. We're going to see flipper-type degeneracy, slider-type degeneracy, and squeezer-type degeneracies. And now that we've identified what these degeneracies are, and there's probably other ones that we haven't systematically found, you can then say, okay, here's a model that's consistent with this data. Oh, wait, maybe there's degeneracies. Maybe I should consider another inverted hierarchy, for example. Okay, so this is our model. Let's start off with the statistics of the MSSM. I'm just going to remind you of the birthday problem. Let's start with a very simple statistical question. This is more of a pigeonhole principle than the birthday problem. How many models are there that we care about? And how many experimentally distinguishable outcomes are there at the LHC? So I'm calling this the number of signature bins. This is something that experimentalists will tell us we have no control over. On this side, something that theorists do have control over, the number of models that we care about. And this is the number of models that we care about measured in some desired parameter accuracy. So you can imagine binning up the MSSM, binning up these 15 parameters into 10% intervals, and that will give you some number of the number of models there are. If you're someone who just cares about, is it Susie, and you don't really care about the spectrum at all, then the number of models is 1. And the number of distinguishable experimental outcomes at the LHC that could give you, that could be consistent with Susie, is much, much more than 1. So there you say there aren't any degeneracies. But if the number of models is bigger than the number of signature bins, then by the pigeonhole principle, you're guaranteed to have degeneracies at the LHC. Okay, so we need to figure out how to count the number of models, the number of signature bins. So I'm going to tell you the way to count the number of models is just have a number of models in your mind. I'm going to give you the number 10 to the 8. There's 10 to the 8 MSSM, so I'll justify that later. Let's figure out how many experimentally distinguishable outcomes there are at the LHC. And for this, we can use kind of throwing balls into bins argument, that this is the number of experimentally distinguishable outcomes at the LHC. There's n bins. Here are the number of models that we simulate. We're going to simulate randomly a bunch of models. So if we have n balls, and we're throwing them into n bins, if n is much, much less than n, then it's very unlikely that two balls will end up in the same bin. But there's a small probability that two balls will end up in the same bin. And the number of the times this happens goes like m squared over n. Similarly, the number of times that three balls end up in the same bin goes as m cubed over n squared. So for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to leave out the last 4,000 models that we simulated, so I don't have to change my slides. We've simulated 39,137 MSSTs. This is the number of balls that we've made. We throw them down. We calculate their LHC signatures. And we find that 364 have matching LHC signatures. That means the number of signature bins is roughly 4 times 10 to the 6. The number I just said before, the number of MSSMs, this is basically literally from taking that 15-dimensional parameter space and binning it up into chunks of 10 with a couple of modifications, is around 10 to the 8. And therefore, by the pigeonhole principle, the probability of choosing the correct model of the LHC is 1 in 25. That is, if you have one model that's consistent with the data, there's 24 other models that will have the same LHC signatures. Again, this is a very general way of trying to diagnose whether or not you have degeneracies. You figure out how many models you think there should be and count the number of signature bins by doing this birthday problem of seeing how many times two things end up in the same bin. If this isn't satisfying, let me give you another way of saying the exact same story. We have 364 pairs of matching LHC models. OK, so what? Maybe some of those pairs are ones that we like that they're the same. Maybe they only differ in 5% in their parameter value. So we can calculate the number of real degeneracies by the number of matching pairs divided by the number of good pairs. So for example, if I want to know the Beno, the Weno, the Higzino, and the Galeno masses to 10%, and if I don't care about anything else, I could live without knowing tangent beta, live without knowing the mass of the fermions. All I want is I want to know the electrically, or the gauge-geno and Higgs-geno sector to 10%. I find that 30 out of my 364 pairs satisfy this criteria. 30 models are such that I got a good match. And therefore, we expect the number of degeneracies to be 12. Now, these numbers, it's interesting. These numbers are kind of 12, 25, maybe 100. They're order one-ish. These are not huge numbers of degeneracies, so it's not like where things are completely impossible at the LHC. You can imagine hiring 12 graduate students to look at each of these 12 models, if you could find them, look at each of these 12 models and come up with clever ways of distinguishing between them. So it's not 10 to the 6 degeneracies, it's not one degeneracy. Let me convince you that there are degeneracies in a real sense. If we adjust the criteria, so here's the criteria I'm going to use. I want to know the Gauge-genos and the Higgs-genos to a certain percent. If I want to know it to 10%, this is my number 12. If I allow it to slide out to 20%, you see the number of degeneracies goes down. But it doesn't asymptote to 1. It's not like I can make the error arbitrarily large on these things and then the degeneracies go away. It asymptotes to 2. That is, even if I allow for 100% variation in the parameters, I still find that I find degeneracies. And this is an evidence for discrete choices. There's a problem of how well you can measure things. Obviously, if you really want to measure things to 5% accurate, then you have a lot of degeneracies, just because two models that differ by 5%, OK, if you call them degenerate, they may be qualitatively the same. But the thing you should focus on is that even if you increase the parameter acceptance, that you still find discrete choices. And the number of discrete choices increases if you include the squarks. If you include the squarks, and you see even after we sweep it out, it gets down to 3 or 4, that there are discrete ambiguities here. Flips of the spectrum that are going on that are causing these degeneracies. OK, so I'm trying to make an argument that there are degeneracies, but I think now you want to know, OK, what the heck models are you doing? What kind of data are you using? Let's get into more of an interpretation. What kind of models am I using for this study? I'm using a parameter range that isn't one that most people, I can't guarantee that every model here has a nice ultraviolet origin. I can't say that these are all nice, like gauge-mediated models or anomaly-mediated models, but they're kind of reasonable parameter values. For purposes of making sure that the cross-section isn't too huge, I'm forcing colored objects, that is galenos and squarks, to be between 600 and 1 TeV, and I sweep linearly in mass. And I sweep everyone else, the Beno, the Weno, the Higgs-geno, and the sleptons, between 100 GeV and 1 TeV. I vary 10 beta between 2 and 50. And I separate the spermions into first and second generation left and right, first and third generation left and right. And for the squarks, I also split the up from the down. in order to avoid this problem of large flat directions, I force that no particle is more than 50 GeV decoupled. That is, if we have some cascade decay, like the one I've drawn up here, here's a typical SUSY decay. We have squarks coming in. T-channel Galeno gives you two, sorry, quarks coming in. T-channel Galeno gives you two squarks. And the squarks then cascade. It may cascade to a quark and an LSD, or it may cascade to an electroweakino, and then to a slepton, and then to the LSD. I'm going to force that the maximum colored object is greater than the maximum electroweakino object, is greater than the maximum slepton, to allow for at least the possibility. It may be phase trace suppressed, it may be branching ratio suppressed, but at least the possibility for all of the K modes to be present. And because Pythia crashes, Pythia is the event generator that we use, we're going to force the LSP to be one of the electroweakinos. So these are, again, scanning all these things linearly, 39,137 MSSMs.
So why is that last criterion, no slepton LSP again?
No slepton LSP. So the LSP could conceivably be, you could have a stable neutral particle like a neutrino LSP. Pythia, which is the event generator that we use, assumes that the LSP is a neutralino. And so in order to satisfy that constraint, we make sure that the LSP is a neutralino. So this is not every SUSY scenario.
Or that's just done for methodological reasons, basically.
Right, but people might wonder, well, can you tell, I might be interested in the question, can you tell a neutrino LSP from a neutralino type LSP at the LHC? Unfortunately, I can't answer that question because of this constraint.
Right.
Yeah. How do we generate these models? Well, we have to use cluster computers to give you a sense of how long it takes to do this. One model takes you about one CPU hour. So you get one model per CPU per hour. Even with 39,137 MSSMs, even with our friends at the Harvard Center for Astrophysics, they have a machine called Sauron, another astrophysics cluster at the University of Michigan, they call it machine Opus. Still took quite a long time. We use Pythia, which is a very standard event generator, and then pass it through a pretty good simulation package. This is something to try to mimic what the LHC will do to data. Basically, assemble calorimeter cells into objects. And we have roughly 2 terabytes of storage for raw data like this. Here's a single event. And what this event has is it has line particle type 6 is missing energy. It has missing energy. There's 23 GeV of it. This is the azimuthal angle that it's pointing in. These 4s mean jets. We have some jets. They have a particular pseudorapidity, a particular phi, a particular PT. Basically, these are just the 4 vectors of objects coming out of the detector. And we take these objects coming out of the detector, combine them in various ways to make LHC observables, and that's what data is going to do. To give you a sense of what goodness means, this is what I call a good pair. These are 2 models in our database. I chose model 2005, this is a slide from last year, and model 32,444. These models have the same LHC signatures. And we see that they differ a little bit, but they differ in ways that we're not surprised about. Basically, you model A, you read things vertically. Model B, you read things horizontally. We see that, okay, the hexeno mass has shifted a little bit between the 2 models. The weno mass has shifted a little bit between the models. The things that shifted the most are the sleptons, but here the sleptons never get made. They're effectively decoupled. Why is that? Sleptons can only be made from a cascade from an electroweakino, but we see that the electroweakino that's heavier than the sleptons is the beno. The gluino decays to the beno, could conceivably decay to the sleptons, but because the gluino decays to the beno, let's see, it's probably big enough so it's not kinematically suppressed, but its branching ratio is probably small, and therefore you never ever get a chance to make these sleptons. So I'm not surprised that we see that degeneracy in the slepton spectrum. But I'm going to call this a good pair. Later on, I'll show you bad pairs. Okay. Now, as I was mentioning before, sleptons are often decoupled in these theories. Even though we said we're going to make sure that there's always a decay path available, as that example showed, it just may be that their branching ratio is suppressed. And so we have 2 different scenarios that you could have. If the sleptons are off-shell, we get huge information from this diagram. But if the sleptons aren't off-shell, then every time you see leptons, they're basically just coming from W's and Z's. And W's and Z's are plenty at the LHC. Anytime you have a top, you're going to have a W. You have soft W's from various places. And so because you very rarely have these cascade decays from an electroweak amino into a slepton amino, the only information that you get about your SUSY signal is that, oh, there's W's and Z's around. Well, that allows for the possibility of degeneracies because there isn't that much information contained in the fact that you have W's and Z's. As I mentioned before, while this diagram dominates in my database, if I were to do a database made up entirely of minimal supergravity or gauge-mediated models, then this diagram would dominate. And doing that study, this is a cascade run where we force cascades to occur. With 27,000 models, we find that there are virtually no degeneracies. So this captures our intuition that sleptons are the key, and the reason why people have been so optimistic about SUSY in the past. If you have on-shell sleptons, then things are very nice for SUSY, at least for distinguishing SUSY among itself. There may be degeneracies between SUSY and other types of models, but for SUSY among itself, you can't get away with flipping the spectrum, doing all these crazy things if you have sleptons in the game. But sleptons are not generically in the game if you just randomly scan over parameters. Okay, so I've told you what models you have. What kind of data do we have? Let's see. So some of you were here for this morning, so you've heard some of this before. So here is a typical SUSY decay. Again, you're going to have quarks coming in, giving you squarks. And in this cascade, we see that every time you make a squark, you get a quark. Every time you make a squark, you get a quark. And because the squarks carry R parity, each of these decay chains end in an LSB. And so a typical SUSY decay has two jets and missing energy. Now, if we were to start off with gluinos, if instead we had our first SUSY particles, we pair produce gluinos, then gluinos would decay. They have to decay to a quark and a squark, and then the squark decays as it did before. Let's say it decays to an LSB. So in this side, we get two jets. So basically, mnemonic, squark, anytime you make a squark, you get one jet. Anytime you get a gluino, you roughly can get two jets. And so for all the models that we're looking at, the characteristic signatures are going to be lots of jets, lots of missing energy. And that's what we're looking for. And we're going to take those events and bin them in all sorts of different ways. How can you bin them? You could say, OK, I have events with four jets. I'm going to plot the PT of the hardest jet. I have three jets. I'm going to take two of those jets and construct an invariant mass. You can imagine coming up with all sorts of data. Whether that data is useful or not is another question. But it's not too difficult to come up with a list of 1,800 different signatures based on the fact that you have lots of jets, lots of single T. Other things that you could do, as I was telling people this morning, you can construct the invariant mass out of these leptons. And if you construct the invariant mass out of these leptons, you often get very interesting patterns. For example, you can get kinematic edges from the decay of an enovirus lepton to an LSB. Obviously, you can get peaks that correspond to Z's. And so what we do is we basically, any observable that we've ever seen in the literature, we throw into a giant pile. And that's going to be our data. Now, given that data, you might say, OK, great, you have that data. How are you going to convert that data into something you care about, that is, whether models are degenerate or not? And so we can define a signature distance between models. And basically, what a signature distance between models is just what you would do for a chi-square. You sum over the different signatures that you have. You have the difference in the signature values, so signature for model 1 minus signature for model 2 divided by the error between those squared. This is going to give us a signature distance. And you can imagine also having a parameter distance, which is just the sum over n of some parameter values over some error, whatever that means. For example, in our study, we used something like 10% error as a way of telling us whether how different models work. And then you can go and plot signature versus parameter. So imagine we're making a plot of, let's see, the parameter distance versus the signature distance between models. So a given pair of models, let's say that good pair that I had, they were close in parameter space, and they were close in signature space. So that pair of models landed here. A degeneracy is a pair of models who are very far away in parameter space, but close in signature space. That is, their chi-square value is small. So a degeneracy would appear there. And if you have two models that are very close to parameter space, but very far off in signature space, we call this a clip. And this is what everyone else is focused on. That is, in order that if you have two models that are very close to each other in parameter space, they may be wildly different in signature space, which means that if you trust your theory, then that means you can make really accurate measurements on given parameters. So clips are good. That means we are sensitive to parameters. LHC data is sensitive to parameters. Degeneracies are bad. That means that given a certain signature distance that we define as being close enough, we have two models that are qualitatively different. And if I plot this for a specific parameter, you can see what a degeneracy looks like. So why electroweak Eno degeneracy? Why is there a possibility of ambiguity? Well, if I plot the difference between two models in their Beano value versus their signature distance, what this plot looks like is the following. It looks encouraging to start. You find that if the Beano mass parameters are small, the difference in each of the Beano mass parameters are small, then they're going to be close to signature space. But then something funny happens. Again, these are all pairs of models. And let's say I define this cut to be models that are sufficiently close to call close enough. We see that while there's a region where if you're close in parameter space, you're also close in signature space. There's another region, the degenerate region, which is separated in value from this, which also has exactly the same signature, but wildly different Beano mass. And so the fact that we have this disconnected structure means that we really do have qualitatively different spectra that can give you the same LHC signatures. And so seeing this tells you that you have a degeneracy, or a degeneracy within a Beano choice. Just to give you a sense of what other plots would look like if I were to do the same plot. If I were to do the same plot for Delta Gluino, you find it looks like this. That is, you can't change the Gluino mass very much without totally drastically changing LHC signatures. This is something you'd expect. The Gluino dominantly sets the cross-section for SUSY. And if I took a value that a lot of people care about, can you measure tan beta? And what tan beta looks like on this plot is just the following, that you just have no sensitivity to tan beta. That two models, whether they are close or far away in signature space, doesn't tell you anything about their tan beta. So okay, tan beta is just a flat direction. But this is the real story. Degeneracy from the electroweak Eno system. So just to recap, what we've done is we've done what, even though we haven't put standard model background in our story, we're going to put some triggers to make sure that we only look at events that have smallest standard model background. We force a huge amount of missing ET. Well, that's not that huge. Some amount of missing ET. We force that we have a lot of hard jets. And then we just categorize everything by the number of jets, number of BTAG jets, electrons, muons, hadron, and tau. And we do everything in ratios so that, because you can't really measure the luminosity of the machine very well, you don't want to get confused saying models are degenerate because they differ in the number of events, but you can't measure the number of events very carefully. And the only error that we're using for this study is just statistical error. And for just to keep things sane, a 1% error on all signatures, and to account for the fact that luminosity isn't measured that well, we have an extra 15% error on the number of events. And this is what I was telling people about this morning, that you can use these edges and endpoints to capture a lot of information about the event kinematics. And we just take whatever distribution might or might not have an endpoint, we quantile it, we separate the distribution into deciles or 20 tiles, and we try to match entire distributions. So this gives you a huge number of signatures. Every histogram ends up being 20 data points. Plug it in, calculate the chi-squared, and we find that structure for the delta p, delta x plot, which tells us we have the degenerates. Here's some data. This is the pair of models that are not degenerate. I'm glad these are degenerate, but you can get a sense of what things that look the same are, the kind of data we're using. Here are the number of leptons in events. So 70% of the events have no leptons, 20% of the events have one lepton, for example. In one lepton events, 25% have four jets. Similar things, we sum the PT in all events with zero leptons, draw a histogram just showing you how the deciling works. We take the PT of all electrons, okay. data, more data, all gets pumped in. Oh, apparently this model has a lot of Zs, that's nice. And then some ones that we have no idea why they would work, or if they give you any useful information, take the hardest tau and the hardest jet and construct their invariant mass. It would be a sign of leptoquarks if you have it. Okay. So that's data. So I hope I've convinced you that there's at least the possibility of degeneracy is in two ways, one by this plot, and the other one by this counting at the very beginning. If we did these 39,000 models, we found that 300 had matching pairs, even when we expected only 30 should be matching pairs. But what are these degeneracies? How can we get a qualitative feel for what they are and what we can do about them? So this is still an open question, and a question we're working actively on. Are these degeneracies, are they fundamentally indistinguishable at the LHC, or are there new clever observables to break them? Well, before doing that, let's catalog what the dominant forms of degeneracies are. If we look in our database, what are the models that tend to be the most often degenerate? What features do they share? And I claim that they can be categorized into three classes, flippers, sliders, and squeezers. And I think for you, this is the meat of the talk. If you want to think about Susie, this is the beginning point to how to disentangle Susie from itself. First is a flipper degeneracy. Again, these are two models that are close. And how close? They are closer to each other than they were to themselves run with a different random number seed. So these are models that are very close. They have identical signatures. Why are these the same, and what are the same about them? Well, we see they both have the same Luino mass, so that's going to tell us that they roughly have the same cross-section. We see that the squarks are a little bit shuffled around, but most of them are kind of close to the line. We have some sleptons down here, but I claim that these are decoupled, or mostly decoupled. What's the biggest difference between these models is the identity of the LSP. Is the LSP a Wino, as it is in Model A, or is the LSP a Beano, as it is in Model B? This is a flipper degeneracy. We flipped the identity of the LSP from being Beano-like to Beano-like, and that looks like two parameters being flipped across the axis. How is this a degeneracy? Wait, aren't these completely different theories? A Beano is one degree of freedom. A Wino, one neutral degree of freedom. A Wino is one neutral and two charged degrees of freedom. But the charged degrees of freedom in the Wino are so close to the neutral degrees of freedom that the decay from the charge to the neutral guy is virtually invisible. And so you can never tell. And so in cascades that involve a Beano or a Wino at the very end, you can't tell the fact that you're landing on three states. In the case of the Wino LSP, you're just landing on one state in the case of the Beano LSP. So this happens all the time. We call this flipper degeneracy. One that you might not be so surprised is a degeneracy is a slider degeneracy. That's when the entire spectrum just shifts up. And the amount that it can shift up is the amount by which we can nail the cross-section of the theory. Basically, these kind of kinematic distributions that you can draw are very good at measuring mass differences, not as good at measuring masses. And so leaving the mass difference fixed, we can just slide the whole spectrum up. Slide the degeneracy. I think most people knew about this kind of degeneracy well before our study. One that I find particularly fascinating is a squeezer degeneracy. This is a case when an extra state lands on your LSP. So your LSP in one model is pure Wieno with a Wieno virtually decoupled. Another model, the Wieno and the Wieno are right on top of each other, and it's the same story as before. You can't tell how many states you have at low energies because the decay from one state to another is different. Is invisible. And note that in this particular model, almost everything else is along the axis except the sleptons, which have moved, and the Galeno that has moved a little bit off axis. But the dominant degeneracy, or dominant change in these models, is the identity of the LSP. In one case, it's pure Wieno; the other one is mixed Wieno Wieno. So this is the challenge for the LHC. After we get evidence for physics beyond the standard model, can we disentangle these and other types of degeneracies? And we've looked through our database to see if there's any other qualitative things you can do. So one thing that we're looking at, we haven't found any excellent examples of it, but one category of degeneracies that we're trying to study is the following. And we have model A and model B. In one model, you have a Wieno over here and a Wieno down here. So you have a Wieno and Wieno that are flipping. But at the exact same time, the left-handed and right-handed squarks also flip in order to keep the cross-section the same. And the Galeno is decoupled, so the Galeno doesn't play much role in the dynamics. Because the left-handed guys always go to the Wieno, that you can kind of adjust these things around in such a way that you can get the same cross-section and same kinematics, despite the fact that the left-hand just goes to Wieno, whereas the Wieno talks to both the left-hand and the right-hand. So we're trying to figure out how generic or common this kind of left-right flip degeneracy is. That's something that's working on. Okay. So here's what I want you to take away from this talk. If you have a favorite theory, then you should be happy, because when the LHC turns on, if the data is consistent with your theory, then you're going to measure the parameters very accurately in that theory. This is the presence of these clips I was telling you about. In reduced parameter sets, especially if you have sleptons on shell, you're going to get a lot of information out of the LHC. But if the sleptons are not on shell, then there are qualitatively different MSSMs consistent with the same experimental data. And this means for those of us trying to figure out what the real story is, we should have these types of degeneracies in our mind. Can you change the order of the electroweak Wieno sector? If it's consistent with one model, can you manufacture a degeneracy? And of course, you can't just do a flip like that. You can't just flip the electroweak Wieno sector. You have to flip that and then make compromising adjustments among your color guys in order to have the same cross-section time branch sharing ratio to be the same. So it's not just you flip things and everything's fine. You flip things and then you make other adjustments on the top. And 200 GeV, I think you'll all agree, can change a huge amount. Changes whether the gauge unit is unified, changes the identity of the LSP, whether it could be a good thermal relic dark matter candidate. I've given you two themes today, statistics and the inverse problem. This birthday problem method is a very powerful way of assessing the degree of one-to-oneness among a class of theories. It doesn't help you break degeneracies, unfortunately, but it helps you identify them. And if you have a big enough computer and an interesting enough class of models, you can always use this technique to assess whether there's degeneracies within that class. In particular, in the case of our study, what we found most interesting was about SUSY sleptons on the LHC, that when the sleptons are in the game, no degeneracies. When they're out of the game, you have this discrete ambiguity in the electroweak Wieno sector. The lessons that you should take away, okay, this one's obvious, that if we want to nail the MSSM or any other theory at the LHC, we have to drastically increase the number of independent LHC signatures. As I said, this story was just for 10 inverse spectrobarns. How does the story change for 300 inverse spectrobarns and when you add standard model background? We're actively working on that to try to make this as realistic a story as possible. And if you do have a new signature, if you say, hey, I like your 1800 signatures, here's 200 more. We can plug it into our software, calculate the new expectation value of the degeneracies, see whether it went down. If it did, great. You've helped us break degeneracies. And I, again, want to emphasize that these statistical techniques are useful as a diagnostic tool. But I'm not sure how, when the LHC actually turns on, you'll be able to rule in models. The fact that you have this flip structure where you move a model a little bit and the signatures change a lot means that it's very difficult to find degeneracies. That even if you think they exist, you can scan around really, really hard and just not be able to land on it because of the clippy structure of the map from parameter space to signature space. And let me end with an invitation to you to think about the LHC inverse problem. There's very little work in this direction. We've only done it for the MSSM, but there's very interesting stuff to go from the MSSM versus the NMSSM versus universal extra dimensions, T-pairs of little pigs. These all have challenging decay topologies from the point of view of the LHC. And one easy way to get involved, this is what I was talking about in the morning, was get involved in the LHC Olympics. This is using competition as a motivation for interpreting data. So this was using a computer to interpret data. 40,000 models, computer, tell me what the answer is, or tell me what the degeneracy story is. Here it's you and your brain. And can you determine what the spectrum of a theory is? This morning I told you about this wonderful degeneracy between the model proposed by Herman Verlinde and Leonardo Rastelli for the second LHC Olympics compared to the actual one. It was a degeneracy. They gave qualitatively the same LHC signatures. There's happened to be wrong, but with standard model background, it's hard to tell the difference between the two of them. The second LHC Olympics was back in February. There's going to be a new one in August with new black boxes presented by new teams. And hopefully, we'll be able to expand on our current tools, which are just experience, intuition, consensus, and luck. Hopefully, we'll have some new things to present to the experimentalists, new ways of interpreting data, breaking degeneracies, and figuring out what the correct theory of electroweak physics is. So let me end there and take more questions.
Any more questions?
Yes.
Almost, I can get my...